So in the last chapter, Krishna said, Karanam Gunasangasya Sarasad Yoni Janmasu. So one might wonder, well, what are these gunas? And how does one associate with them? What are the symptoms of one who's influenced by them? And what are the results of such association? And of course, one would also wonder, how can one become free from the influence of the modes? So expecting these questions, the Lord is making a declaration in chapter 14, in the first verse, to introduce the subjects here on which he will elaborate. So he begins speaking. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Param Puya Pravakshyami Jnananam Jnanam Uttamam Yajgyatva Munaya Sarve Param Siddhim Mito Gadaha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, again, I shall declare to you this supreme wisdom, the best of all knowledge, knowing which all the sages have attained the supreme perfection. Prabhupada comments, from the 7th chapter to the end of the 12th chapter, Sri Krishna in detail reveals the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now the Lord himself is further enlightening Arjuna. If one understands this chapter through the process of philosophical speculation, he will come to an understanding of devotional service. In the 13th chapter, it was clearly explained that by humbly developing knowledge, one may possibly be freed from material entanglement. It has also been explained that it is due to association with the modes of nature that the living entity is entangled in this material world. Now, in this chapter, the Supreme Personality explains what those modes of nature are, how they act, how they bind, and how they give liberation. The knowledge explained in this chapter is proclaimed by the Supreme Lord to be superior to the knowledge given so far in other chapters. By understanding this knowledge, various great sages attain perfection and transfer to the spiritual world. The Lord now explains the same knowledge in a better way. This knowledge is far, far superior to all other processes of knowledge thus far explained. And knowing this, many attained perfection. Thus it is expected that one who understands this 14th chapter will attain perfection. So, there's a lot of interesting statements in the commentary there that might engender questions in your fertile minds. I was going to say fertile brains, but I didn't make it sound derogatory. One is that if one understands the process of philosophical, this chapter through the process of philosophical speculation, he'll come to understand devotional service. Wait a minute, I thought we're not supposed to speculate. What's going on here? Prabhupada's telling us to speculate philosophically on this chapter. So, yes. That's part of our process, actually. And that's called manana. Shravana, manana, and nididhyasana. You're hearing, and then reflecting upon the knowledge, or questioning the knowledge, and trying to understand how the knowledge is true. Right? That's kind of called philosophical speculation. See, when the goal is to understand the Lord and one is using the Shastra, then it's called philosophical speculation. And when one has no goal and is just whimsically spinning his mind and his brain in a circle, then that's called mental speculation. So that's what we reject. But philosophical speculation, that is, not only is it accepted, but it's actually good. And it's desired that we, as Prabhupada said, we try to understand the philosophy from different angles of vision. all angles of vision. And he wrote to one devotee named Chatur Bhuj in one letter from Bombay in 72. He wrote, "My dear Chatur Bhuj, please accept my blessings, etc." I won't read the whole thing. "As for the difference between mental speculation and philosophical speculation, we take it that everything is known by the psychological action of the mind, so that philosophical speculation is the same as mental speculation if it is merely the random or haphazard activity of the brain to understand everything and make theories, ifs and maybes. But if philosophical speculation is directed by Shastra and Guru, and if the goal of such philosophical attempts is to achieve Vishnu, then the philosophical speculation is not mental speculation. It is just like this. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, 'I am the taste of water.' Philosophical speculation, in the accepted sense, then means to try to understand, under the direction of Shastra and Guru, just how Krishna is the taste of water. The points of Bhagavad Gita, though they are simple and complete, can be understood from unlimited angles of vision. So our philosophy is not dry like mental speculation. The proper function of the brain or psychological activity is to understand everything through Krishna's perspective. And so there is no limit to that understanding because Krishna is unlimited. And even though it can be said that the devotee who knows Krishna, he knows everything, in the 15th chapter, still, the philosophical process never stops, and the devotee continues to increase his knowledge even though he knows everything. Try to understand this point. It is a very good question." So, that's it. A very full explanation about the difference between these two things. And that's what he's talking about here. So, the next point that one might question is that the modes of nature, how they act, how they bind, and how they give liberation. Because one may think, well, wait a minute, how do the modes of nature give liberation? Right? But if one develops the mode of goodness, then sattvat sanjayate jnanam. He develops knowledge. And from the platform of knowledge, he can advance very quickly in Krishna consciousness. And the mode of goodness allows one to be peaceful, satisfied, concentrate the mind, be pensive and thoughtful, meditative, and free from the pushings of the lower modes, lust and greed. So its mode of goodness is very good for spiritual life. There are some drawbacks to the modes of nature, which we will talk about when we get to the verse. But in general, Prabhupada says that a devotee acts in the mode of goodness. That's his modus operandi, as we say in the West. His M.O. It's a Latin term. It means how he functions. So the mode of goodness is a springboard to the spiritual platform. And we need as much spring as we can get in this Kali Yuga, because every energy is pushing us down. Now, the last question here is that how is this knowledge far, far superior than the previous knowledge? Wait a minute. I thought Krishna, in the ninth chapter, he gave the most confidential knowledge about loving him in pure devotional service, Nanyam Bhakti. And how could he be saying that this knowledge is better? Well, the point or the hint in Prabhupada's words here is that this is superior to all other processes of knowledge thus far explained. So the commentators, Baladeva Dibhushan, he mentions, speaking as Krishna, of course, in his commentary, "Again I will speak a kind of knowledge different from what I have spoken so far. It deals specifically with the modes of material nature. It is the best of all kinds of knowledge about Prakriti and Jiva. and it resembles a distillation of yogurt from milk. Realizing this knowledge and meditating on it thoughtfully, all great sages attained true perception of the Supreme Soul. So is the best kinds of knowledge when, in the regards of this Sambandha Gyan, this about the Jiva and Prakriti specifically. You know, about Abhideya, that's a different thing. The Abhideya, Bhakti Yoga is higher because he's thinking about Krishna, Manmana Bhava Madbhakto. That's higher instruction. But this helps the devotee to follow that in the sense that he can learn how to rise above the modes of nature, come closer to Krishna by supporting his devotion through this knowledge. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says here, jnana is generally sagun. Nirgun jnana is called uttama jnana. Right? Jnanam uttamam is here. By taking shelter of this nirgun jnana, the jiva attains my sadharmya, qualities similar to mine. And Balarama Vidyabhushan mentioned 8 eternal qualities of Krishna. He didn't say what they were, but so the 8 of them. So benefit of this knowledge is param siddhim ito gataha. One attains supreme perfection. What's the proof? Yajgyatva munaya sarve. All of the sages, having understood this knowledge, they achieved this goal. Yeah, well, their goal is not Vishnu, and they're not listening to Shastra and Guru, that's for sure. So, yeah, it's mental speculation. According to Prabhupada's definition, they're not trying to understand the Shastra. And their goal is, I don't know what their goal is, but it's not Vishnu, that's for sure.
It is easy for a person to be situated in three modes of, in the mode of goodness in order to achieve pure devotee. It's a springboard.
That helps.
So that, can you just clarify here? Because I've heard many replies before, but I've really not understood this very clearly. That how, if bhakti, there is no impediment to bhakti, you know, then how being in goodness, it is easier to practice bhakti.
When one is in already in the school of bhakti, in the, doing bhakti sadhana, then he's far better off in the mode of goodness, because then he has much less distractions. Because there's no transformations in the mind. The vikaras in the mind, due to the intense emotions of anger, greed, lust, illusion, etc., are vacant there. So it's like, you know, it's kind of like you can imagine starting bhakti from nishtha. That's very good, because that's the point where you're in the mode of goodness. Sattvastitam sattve prasidati. Devotee in the mode of goodness, he's at nishta. And he's happy, he's freed from tada rajas tamo bhava kama loba dayaschaye cheta eter enavidam stitam sattve prasidati. So just to be at nishta, that's a great, you know, a benediction. That's, you know, maybe the first 20 years or more or struggle of the sadhaka, the kanishta adhikari. It's like struggling to get to nishta for a long time, and some never make it. So if you're in the mode of goodness, that's a very great help. If you're in the process of bhakti. If you're not in the process of bhakti, and if you're not using your knowledge, you know, for the Lord, then you can become degraded in many ways, which we'll discuss. But I mean, the mode of goodness does have some drawbacks, because one becomes proud, And being proud is not good for a devotee. The main thing that he has to develop is humility. So, because he knows how God is great, there and how Vaishnavas are dear to the Lord, so therefore he actually becomes humble. That becomes part of his knowledge. Whereas someone in Sattva-gun, without devotional practice, without devotional goal, and without devotional knowledge from the Shastras, then he can very easily slip up, and in fact he'll probably not come to bhakti unless he gets converted or something somehow. Everyone has to come to the mode of goodness sooner or later, so it should be sooner.
Then bhakti becomes conditional, doesn't it?
Huh?
It becomes conditional. Bhakti doesn't have any material impediments, you're saying.
No, the bhakti helps to bring one to Gmargunas and beyond, to Nirgun. Because bhakti is Nirgun. But when you're doing bhakti, then it's purifying. Shinvadama Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Rajantasta Avadhanri Vidunoti Suritsatam. So it's cleansing all of the sinful desires, which are mainly there in the rajas and tamas. So if we can get freed from rajas and tamas, that's a great step forward for us. It's a simple point, I think.
When the deity was threatened and he gave up his life, or something like that. And
he gave up his arm.
Yeah.
In Africa.
He died, I think. Yeah. Trying to protect his the deities.
Uh-huh.
And he was like Kshatriya kind. He was like very Rajogunic. And he attacked the people and... Do anyone remember this? Master? And... then what happened? Prabhupada said that because of his quality of trying to protect the devotee, though he was in whatever mode, he will go back to God.
Yeah.
So it's, and we see even in various situations, like Gajendra was in the material body, and he went back to God. He was like in an elephant's body, which is like in.
Okay, but they're quoting very rare incidences here. Someone gives up his life protecting the deity. That's very, very special. Can you turn it down a little bit? And Gajendra is also a very rare circumstance. A devotee in an elephant body. Like Sri Gopal, the Rasikananda met the elephant and initiated him. Right? And it's very rare, this kind of, We can't take these the rare exceptions and try to make them the rule. In any case, bhakti brings one to goodness and beyond. But such kind of bhakti that they're talking about there is very rare. I mean, Gajendra, he was a very pious king. He made some aparad to Rishi, and so he ended up in the body of an elephant. But he was remembering and offering prayers. So it's a very rare, these are rare circumstances. It can happen, because bhakti is very powerful and the Lord's very merciful. I mean, Putana also got liberation, but it doesn't mean we're going to try to kill Krishna or smear blood, poison on our breasts. Or, it's not our process. Some services require the mode of passion. I don't think I accept this statement. Your Mahavakyam. Some services require the mode of passion. I have a serious doubt about that statement. Yeah, heavy, but it doesn't mean you have to be in the mode of passion. I mean, Prabhupada did everything right? He cooked a lot of prasadam for people. He served prasadam. He distributed books. He met people. He preached. He made friends with people. But he didn't do it in the mode of passion. I mean, you can do anything in any different mode of nature. Of course, some activities, might tend to bring one to passion, like, you know, maybe being a taxi driver in Bombay. You know what I mean? It would be hard to remain in the mode of goodness, right? If you were in New York or in Bombay and daily driving a taxi all day long. Unless you're a Paramahamsa. And then what the hell are you doing in a taxi anyway, driving a taxi, right? So... You know, so it's possible. Anyway, devotees, we're going to talk about that. But you know, generally we would try to avoid such things. But you know, cooking prasadam is a activity of a Brahmin, and preaching and distributing books is a Brahminical activity. It should be done in the mode of, not only in the mode of goodness, but higher than that. I mean, you know, Mother Yashoda was churning butter and then got up and ran to the stove to catch the milk. Was she in the mode of passion? No, but she was active. See, active doesn't necessarily mean the mode of passion. And we'll see. Let us study, you know, what are the lakshanas of Rajagun and Sattvagun. I mean, yeah, miracles do happen sometimes. Yeah, of course. I mean, look at Magrari the hunter. He became a pure devotee, like, overnight. Right? And before, he was not only killing, but half-killing animals and enjoying it. And then, you know, Narada gave him a practical demonstration and just, you know, in a few hours, he became a great Vaishnava. Or this prostitute that came to Haridas Thakur, you know, in whatever it was, you know, 36 hours or something, she became a pure Vaishnava. So, there are exceptions. The power of bhakti is, you know, unlimited. But those kind of things don't happen to all Vaishnavas at all times. So we have to look at the general situation, understand the tattva. Rupa Goswami also says that although, you know, some people might have looked at the Rathiyatra card and just immediately went back to Godhead, but most people, you know, it doesn't happen to all people at all times. These quotations are true, but and they're stated to exhibit the power, the angas of bhakti, but they don't necessarily mean that they're always happening for everybody. So we can simultaneously have faith in the power of bhakti, but at the same time understand the practical reality of coming to the mode of goodness and then going forward. It doesn't mean, just to say that, yeah, we have to come to the mode of goodness doesn't negate all of the other statements that are in the Shastras, that we have to give up our faith in the power of bhakti and the mysticism of faith in the guru and, you know, all of these things. Those are also there. The absolute truth is a multifaceted diamond. Right? It's not one side, or two, or three, or four. It's many, many, many sides. So you have to understand the whole thing. Then you know tattva. Then you can explain any point, because it's true. It's just a matter of understanding how all those points are related to one another in right perspective. Okay, let's go to text two. Krishna's glorifying the knowledge that he's going to speak, which he usually does, right? Especially in these, in the middle six chapters, he did that. in 7 and 9, right, in 10. And he's doing it again here. Idam jnanam upashritya mama sadharma agataha sargepi nopajayante pralayena vyatanti cha. By becoming fixed in this knowledge, one can attain to the transcendental nature like my own. Thus established, one is not born at the time of creation or disturbed at the time of dissolution. So the word sadharmya, the acharyas have kind of gone through great lengths to show that does it mean that you become God, right? Which you can understand. Prabhupada mentions also at the end of his commentary a little bit. But here, sadharmyam means sarupya, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur also confirmed that. So you get, you, as Prabhupada translated, a nature, you develop or attain a nature like the Lord's, right? Similar to the Lord's, not that you become the Lord or something like this. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says this knowledge comes by worshipping the Guru. That's how one develops this. Prabhupada says, to obtain such knowledge, it's the last sentence, or last two, one must develop all the spiritual qualities. One who thus develops the spiritual qualities is not affected either by the creation or by the destruction of the material world. So, navyatanti cha, he's not disturbed the time of dissolution or the time of death. That was my own vision on it, it seems. I mean, this is to develop knowledge is abhideya also, but this is knowledge about prakriti and jiva. It's, as Prabhupada said, a process of knowledge. So bhakti, as described, Ananya Bhakti in 934, is not a process of knowledge, although one gets knowledge, but it's a process of bhakti, of worship, of devotion, of dedication and service to the Lord. So that's a different thing. One automatically gets knowledge. Here one's specifically going for just knowledge. So one might ask, how does the birth of this creation take place? He mentioned sarga in the previous verse too, sarga, right? So one might wonder, you know, how does this sarga take place? And now Krishna is describing how the jiva enters into the material world. And later he'll say how he also comes in contact with the modes of nature and becomes conditioned by them. So this is the introduction to the chapter. The chapter actually basically has three sections. And depending on, you know, what book or pamphlet or notebook you look at, there's different. Originally, this chapter was divided into three sections, and then it went to five sections, and now it's back to three sections again in the VTE notebook. So the three sections are basically how the living entity comes into the world and meets the modes of nature in the world. Then the middle section describes how he's affected by the modes of nature. And the last section describes how he becomes free from the modes of nature. So the modes of nature are like a prison. So the first section describes how he got in the prison. The middle section describes how those bars keep him locked up in the prison. And the last section describes how he gets out of the prison. So it's very simple. If you think it like that, of it like this, chapter becomes very easy to understand. Okay. Text 3. Mama yonir mahat brahma tasmin garbham dadhamyaham sambhava sarvabhutanam tato bhavati bharata. The total material substance called Brahman is the source of birth, and it is that Brahman that I impregnate, making possible the births of all living beings, O son of Bharat. Mama yonir mahad brahma tasmin garbham dadamyaham. So here the word Brahma means Prakriti. And in the Shrutis, this Brahma is sometimes referred to as, or means Prakriti also. So it's not unusual or unprecedented. Why Prakriti? Because the creation is an expansion of Brahma. So it can also be called Brahma. And the word garbha here means all the jivas, the tatashta jiva shakti. That is what is being injected or impregnated into the mahad brahma. He's giving this, you know, the seed, you know, something, the pregnancy. So in this way, sambhava sarvabhutanam, all living entities take their birth. So when Krishna says, dadami garbham, that I'm giving this pregnancy, I'm giving this garbha, means he's impregnating with his glands. Sa aikshata, sa asrujita. He glanced and he created everything. So he's describing him in the form of Mahavishnu, how he glances over Pradhan Maya and injects the jivas and the kala shakti, as we already discussed, I think, in the first or second class, I think we went through that. So here he's describing this. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that in the Shrutis, the word Brahma is also sometimes used for Prakriti. And Prabhupada says, the Mahat Tattva is the total cause of the total cosmic manifestation, and that total substance of the material cause is sometimes called Brahma. So after the glands and the Kala Shakti and the Jiva Shakti are impregnated into Pradhan, then the Pradhan becomes Mahat Tattva. Because then the unmanifest energies become activated. Then you have the three modes of nature and the time element, which starts to cook everything. Like if you have a big pot of soup, nothing happens until you put it on the flame. So the Kala Shakti is like the flame and starts cooking things. And then you get, you know, transformations in the Pradhan, and it becomes Mahatattva because the modes of nature becomes manifest and active. So he says this Mahatattva is called Brahma sometimes. So Mahat means that it's very great. So there was some description. And I can't remember exactly. But these combination of the words are Mahat Brahma, says. And Prabhupada describes that Mahat means Mahat Tattva. And other acharyas have described that Mahat is kind of like an adjective for Brahma, like the great Brahma. But in any case, the same idea is being expressed. Then Prabhupada says, and he quotes from the Mundaka Upanishad this Shruti statement, Tasmat etad brahmanama rupam anam charjayate. there Brahma is being described as Mahatattva also. Or Mahatattva is described as Brahman there in that statement. And he says, the Supreme Person impregnates that Brahman with the seeds of the living entities. And he also describes it here as the great Brahman, the material nature. So he also uses it as an adjective. And he gives an example that the scorpion lays its eggs in the rice. But people might not see that. They may just see scorpions being born from rice, so then they think that it's kind of magical. So it's the Lord that sends the eggs or the living entities in the material nature, and thus everything comes to life. It's not that it just happens automatically. Well, Krishna said it happens automatically under my will, if you remember. So there is a kind of automation to it, but he's the one who pushes the button. You can say like that. Text 4. Anyway, you should take note of the example. It's in this section, it's an important example.
Mahabrahma refers to Pradhan or Mahatattva?
Huh? Mahabrahma, it refers to Pradhan or Mahatattva? Pradhan? Well, basically it's the same. It's just one phase. Or different phase. Mahatattva is the latter phase. Because he's impregnating the Pradhan. And then it becomes Mahatattva. So, technically, you could say it's Pradhan. Impregnating Pradhan. Sarva yoneshu kaunteya murtaya sambhavanti yaha tasad brahma mahadyoni raham bija pradapita. It should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father. So again, here the word bija means the jivas. And sarva yonishu, and all species of life, the various forms appear, murtaya sabhavanti. They appear as svedaja, in the perspiration, or andaja, in eggs, born from eggs, or udbija, from seeds, or jarayuja, from the womb. Four possibilities are there. And they appear according to their past karma. So the acharyas have commented, demigods, humans, and creatures that fly in the sky, swim in the water, or crawl on the land. According to their karma, I bring them into association with the material nature. Thus, I am Bija Pradapita. So now they're there, right? The living entities have taken birth. They have been impregnated into the material realm. Sattvam rajastama iti guna prakriti sambhavaha nibadnanti mahabaho dehe dehinam avyayam. Material nature consists of three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance. When the eternal living entity comes in contact with nature, O mighty armed Arjuna, he becomes conditioned by these modes. So he comes in contact with the Prakriti, which is filled with gunas, so therefore he becomes bound by those gunas, nibbananti. Dehe, in the body, those living entities, although they're avyayam, indestructible, imperishable, they still get caught. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes as Dehe, is the jiva who has misidentified himself as one with the functions of Prakriti become bound by the gunas. In fact, the jiva is imperishable and free from any contact with matter, but the gunas bind him due to his association with them. This association is caused by his ignorance since time immemorial. So the three modes of nature are now being introduced here. In a more definitive sense. Before they were just mentioned in passing. But here is a verse describing that the living entity comes in contact with the Prakriti, then the gunas bind him. So this is similar to the Mahavakya statement, Karanam Guna Sangasya Sarasat Yoni Janmasu. And here we see that the gunas are consisting of three modes. Or guna can also mean rope. So when you have a rope that binds you, nivananti, then if there's three ropes kind of twisted or entwined together, then it becomes very strong. And there's no way you can get out of that. I mean, one rope itself is strong, but when you have three of them kind of braided together, then you'll never be able to get out from this. It's very, very strong. So Prabhupada also says the living entity is transcendental and has nothing to do with the material nature. Still, because he has become conditioned by the material world, he's acting under the spell of the three modes. Because the living entities have different kinds of bodies, in terms of different aspects of nature, they are induced to act according to that nature. This is the cause of the varieties of happiness and distress. So someone might ask, how do these modes condition the jiva? And now Krishna begins to describe each mode of nature in the next three verses. Tatra sattvam nirmalatvat prakashakam anamayam sukha sangena badnati jnana sangena chanaka. O sinless one, the mode of goodness, being purer than the others, is illuminating, and it frees one from all sinful reactions. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. So the first thing Prabhupada mentions, the living entities conditioned by material nature are of various types. One is happy, another is very active, and another is helpless. Very good description, huh? Happy, active, and helpless. All these types of psychological manifestations are causes of the entity's conditioned status in nature. How they are differently conditioned is explained in this section of the Gita. So, sattva-gun comes first. So it is nirmalatvat. It is pure. And it is prakashakam, and illuminating or enlightening. And anamayam, without sinful reaction. Anamayam also means that, like happiness and peace, no disturbance. There's no vikaras in the heart. All these churning transformations of desire, hate, happiness, distress, envy, anger, greed, lust. There's all these things are not present there. So, and we see that therefore he's peaceful. And therefore happiness only follows peace, right? Krishna said this previously, right, in the second chapter. Right? A person can't be happy unless he's peaceful. So now the in mode of goodness, because the covering is less, someone in the mode of goodness, some knowledge comes through from the heart. The covering is less. And the covering is described later. The mode of goodness is like a mirror covered by dust. It's not so much. Very easily you can wipe that away. But the other coverings are more thick. Some illumination comes through. Just a little dust is there. It's not so heavy. But there's two drawbacks in the mode of goodness, which are given in the second line of the verse. Sukha Sangena and Jnana Sangena. That is the thing that badnati, binds the jiva. Right? So attachment to happiness and attachment to knowledge. The knowledge here means understanding material objects in the proper sense, proper discrimination. So the person, because he's has knowledge, and because he's not affected by the lower reactions and sinful reactions, and he's peaceful, so therefore he feels himself to be slightly superior to others. He feels very satisfied and happy, and he feels a little bit superior to others, Prabhupada mentions in the commentary. The difficulty here is that when the living entity is situated in the mode of goodness, it becomes conditioned and feels that he's advanced in knowledge and better than others. So therefore, he's attached to knowledge because it gives him happiness. And he becomes attached to the means of getting knowledge and happiness. And therefore, this is how the mode of passion sneaks in. Because someone in the mode of goodness, he's not completely in the mode of goodness. There's always a mixture, just like the doshas described in Ayurveda. Someone may be vata dosha, but it doesn't mean he's completely free from pitta and kapha. He's got some of that too, but vata is prominent. So similarly, the person in the mode of goodness, he also has some rajas and tamas, but it's just less. So when he feels quite happy, and jnana sangena and sukha sangena means he's attached to those things, so therefore he's attached to the work or the way that he gets knowledge and happiness, and when there's attachment, that means passion. So passion comes in from this word sangha. So Krishna calls Arjuna anaga, that you're sinless, you don't have these two sins. Or in other words, like warning him, don't develop these two sins, Arjuna. You're quite capable of avoiding these two sins. So make sure you do. Something like this. That's his idea. Prabhupada says that here, he gives some examples. The best example are scientists and philosophers. Of course, you have priests and teachers and all other kinds of persons that are in the mode of goodness. So, they have a sense of advanced happiness, some superiority. I mean, people don't become scientists and teachers because they want money, you know, because they don't get much money. In any country in the world, teachers are probably like the lowest paid professionals other than just, you know, factory workers and so forth. But teachers in every country in the world, they get very little money, probably because of Lakshmi's curse to Bhrigu. Right? So all teachers are very poor, mostly. But they like, you know, they like teaching. So they continue to do, though, even though they're not getting paid a lot of money. So Prabhupada says, but repeatedly, one may become a philosopher, scientist, poet, I guess also teacher or priest, repeatedly and become entangled in the same disadvantages of birth and death. But due to the illusion of the material energy, one thinks that sort of life is pleasant. So that's the problem there, is that it becomes a little bit too self-satisfied. Too satisfied with his material situation. Okay, number 7 describes Rajagun. Rajo ragatmakam vidhi trishna sanga samudbhavam tadnibadnati kaunteya karma sangena deinam. The mode of passion is sport of unlimited desires and longings, O son of Kunti, and because of this, the embodied living entity is bound to material fruitive actions. Mode of passion, rajo, ragatmaka, vidi, raga. It's like you studied, well, you didn't get up to ragatmika bhakti, right? Raganuga bhakti, when there's great attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his form as the son of Nanda Maharaj. But here this ragatmaka is a little bit different, because he has great longings, to enjoy this world. And that is described in the second pada, trishna sangha samudbhavam. And they're born from trishna and sangha. So it's two kinds of raga or attachment. Two kinds of attachment described. Trishna means hankering for sense objects that you do not have. And sangha means attachment for the sense objects you already have. Like children, friends, relatives, home, bank balance, Maruti, bungalow, all the wonderful things of the world. Tannimadnanti, so those are the things that bind him to karma sangena, working to get more and more these things. So he becomes attached to the work which brings those objects. And he's working and working, and he gets something, and then the material nature offers him some new, improved sense objects, and then he feels inspired, and he feels some trishna, hare trishna, trishna, hare hare. And he feels inspired. He does more karma sangha, so more attachment, fruitive work. And he gets those sense objects. He enjoys them. And he feels some few moments of satisfaction. But then he hankers for more. So the material energy offers some new improved sense objects. And then he goes and gets more. So in this way, he's bound to fruitive actions in this material world. Prabhupada mentions modern civilization is considered to be advanced in the standard of the mode of passion. Formerly, the advanced condition was considered the mode of goodness. Like even 100 years ago, especially in India, there were more cultured, sattvic, peaceful people. And that was considered high class. Everyone learned Sanskrit, right, in the schools. And no one was rushing or hankering, to go to stand in line to the American embassy to get a green card. Right? People were peaceful, satisfied. Mode of goodness was people who are cultured and they study Ramayana, Mahabharata, and there was more culture, philosophy. But now, it's like, you know, Bollywood has become very prominent, right? You have a lot of, you know, film stars and entertainers, sports stars. They're the ones that are leading the way now, isn't it? For most people, right? And they're, you know, not quite as cultured as this other kind of learned scholars and, right? These kind of things. Now it's more like entertainment, sports, movies. Right? Everybody's very much in tune with who's the top movie stars and who's the best singers and sports stars and cricket stars. The passion is coming more and more and more. And what to speak of the West? The West is, you know, you have Rambo, Madonna, and I don't even know who they have now. It's probably some new people. Before it was Elvis Presley, and you know, the Beatles, and in the old days. And I was telling some devotees the other day that when Elvis Presley first came onto the scene in America, became famous, they had a special television show, Ed Sullivan show, who he was like, showed all of the new stars and famous people. It was like the talk show, the, you know, entertainment show, the main show in America for many years. So Elvis Presley came on and they showed him. I remember when I was a child, I was watching television, and then, you know, he came on with his guitar and he was shaking his head, his hair was bouncing all around, and, you know, and he, but and he was like, you know, wiggling his hips, dancing the way he does, you know. But they wouldn't show him from, you know, they showed him only from the waist up. And it was considered, it was like forbidden in the TV, you know, in the television show to show him from the waist down. Because he was, you know, wiggling around doing his dancing. So it was like in the late 50s or 60, and maybe around 60, 61, something like this, that was the standard, you know. They would forbid this. It's too risque. It's too controversial. Here's a man, and he's, you know, moving his hips like this. Hey, you know, and we don't want to show that for our young people here because, you know, I mean, God be with us, you know. They were, you know, people were very pious, actually. Even in America, the people were very pious, actually. Of course, now it's like even, you know, even Maharashtra has gone past that stage, right? Isn't it? But even in America, it was that was forbidden. You know, they only showed. Now, when I was preaching in Gujarat in 86, you know, which is whatever, that I went, we were doing life membership, we went into, there was one guy in Ahmedabad who was, he had the monopoly on the VCR. He was the only one importing VCRs in the whole city of Ahmedabad and probably the whole state of Gujarat. And he had people coming in from everywhere, all around the state, to buy a VCR, all the wealthy people, and they were all in his shop. So we went there to make him a life member. Right? So we went to the shop, and it was filled with hundreds of, you know, men, and they were all watching the TVs, and there was different, you know, videos playing. And the most popular one was the, you know, there was a kind of Indian Elvis Presley, and he was up there, you know, playing guitar. And, and she was looking at him. And these 50, 60-year-old men, they were like, they were hypnotized by, you know, I don't know who the, you know the name of the guy, right? Who's the Indian Elvis Presley? These guys were like completely mesmerized, and I went and I just started laughing, you know, it was so funny to me for me to see this. Because for them it was like something new, but from us it was like from the 50s, you know. It's like, really, in the past. But they were hypnotized by the so the motive passion is like creeping in. But like that's what I'm saying. In the old days, you know, there were no VCRs. Now there's Star TV. Now there's all kinds of things. You know, people have become very much degraded by watching these things. I was on the train last year going to Mayapur, and in our compartment there was a honeymooners. There were newlyweds, you know. And they both had jeans and a shirt like this, lady too. So another young girl had come and knocked on the door. I was in the first class compartment actually, and they opened the door. And she said, "Oh, can you please help me?" And she said, "Oh, yes." The girl said, "Oh, how can I help you?" She said, I'm going to a wedding, and can you show me how to put on a sari?" And the other one said, "Okay, let's go." And then they both left. And I thought, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I said to the gentleman, I said, "I thought all Indian ladies know how to put on a sari." I said, he said, "Not now. The culture's changing." You know, it's very common. When I was preaching in Hong Kong in 1981, there are Sindhis there, you know. So there was one man, and he came, I don't know how he came to the temple. He was in the temple, and I asked him, "Oh, would you like some puri and sabji?" He said, "What's that?" I said, "What?" The Indian man who didn't know what is puri and sabji, I was like, "What's going on?" I said, "How long have you been in Hong Kong?" He said, "Oh, about 20 years." You know, people become really, you know, completely lost from their culture. In a very short time, 20, 30, 40 years, the whole thing can change. You can see, watch, it's like going full speed like a snowball downhill. People completely lose everything. So Prabhupada said, now, motive passion is the standard. Right? But before it was the motive goodness. So that means soon it will be the motive ignorance. Then that will be the standard because it's going in that direction. So now he talks about ignorance in the next verse. Tamastvajnanajam vidhi mohanam sarvadehinam pramada lasya nidrabis tannibadnati bharata. O son of Bharat, know that the mode of darkness, sport of ignorance, is the delusion of all embodied living entities. The results of this mode are madness, indolence, and sleep, which bind the conditioned soul. Prabhupada mentions the word two is significant here. It means that the mode of ignorance is a very peculiar qualification of the embodied soul. So Baladeva Vidyabhushan explains the use of the word two here indicates that ignorance is opposed diametrically to the other two modes. How? Well, there's three lakshanas or symptoms of tamagun here: pramad, alasya, and nidra. So pramad opposes goodness, because pramad means foolishness or insanity, madness. And alasya, laziness, opposes passion, because people in passion, they're not lazy, they're quite active. As Prabhupada said, you can leave it like that, that's all right. This is good. And then nidra opposes both goodness and passion. So the word two here sets aside as a separate thing, that it is completely in its own category. And nidra can also mean depression, according to Vishnu Chakravarti. Depression in the mind. Pramad, you know, means kind of, you know, insanity, madness. Alasya, you know, that's your word, right? Lazy. Just like the Saint Tulsidas, he said, Ram nam me arse, Ram nam me arse, Bhojan me husyar. Right? Ram nam me arse, Bhojan mein husiyar. Tulsi ese jivan ko bar bar dichar. Dikar. Okay. Bar bar dikar. He's condemned, right? Again and again. Alasay. So he's lazy. When it comes to chanting the holy name, he's lazy. But when it's time to eat, then he's enthusiastic. So this is the Tamagun Wala. So Prabhupada describes, you know, people in ignorance. He describes that it's kind of illusion that everybody's dying. His father dies, his mother dies, grandfather, grandmother, brother, but he thinks that not me. And he says that he sleeps more than is required. 6 hours is sufficient, but a man in ignorance sleeps at least 10 or 12 hours a day. Such a man appears to be always dejected and addicted to intoxicants and sleeping. Some people in the mode of ignorance, they like to sleep. And they like intoxicants. And they like to stay up all night and sleep in the daytime. And, you know, like in the, especially in the West, I remember there was one devotee named Tulsidas. He came to New York once, and we went to some evening program, and we were coming back. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and in New York, the motorway was packed full of cars, and he was so shocked, you know. He said, "It's 11 o'clock at night. Where are they all going?" I couldn't believe it, you know. He just never saw that, you know, the people staying up all night, practically. And, you know, that's what happens. In the mode of ignorance, in the evening, they feel great energy, great enthusiasm, like rakshasas, you know. Like in Mahabharata, when the night came, right, they became very strong, the rakshasas, because they're in tamagun. So when the tamagun comes in the evening, then they get strength. So the people that come out around 10 o'clock at night in the western cities, and they feel really enthusiastic. And then they go into the bars, the clubs, the discos, they drink, they smoke, and they sit in these tables, and it's very dark. They just some very low lights, you know. They drink more, smoke more. And they sit the whole night, around 4 or 5 in the morning, then they finally open the doors from the club, and the people come out onto the streets. And because I used to drive every morning at 4:15 in London from my flat, which was in South London, to the temple in Central London, and I had to go right past the club district, you know, and I'd see these people coming out on the street, you know, at 4:15, 4:30, like this. They're half naked and they're like drunk, they're falling all over, they're intoxicated, and they're just going home to go to sleep. And I'm going to Mangalarti, you know. But that's how, like, so then they, you know, they get home around 5 or 6, they go to sleep, they wake up at around 2 or 3 or 4 in the afternoon, have their breakfast, you know. Or maybe they wake up at 5 or 6, I don't know, if they sleep 12 hours, you know. And then they call a few friends and watch a little TV. And then around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, they're really ready to go again. Go out and hit the town. Go out to the clubs. I remember when I was a young kid, there were some clubs in New York City. They didn't open until 12 midnight. Yeah, they didn't even open until midnight. Those were like the real high club, you know, high class clubs, you know, big. I can tell you a lot more about New York City, but I try to keep it within the context of the philosophy. The mode of ignorance is very, very strong there, you know. And the people are very, very bewildered. They're very sinful. So, let us see here. The last verse just summarizes the whole thing. Sattvam suke sanjayati raja karmani bharata jnanam avritya tutama pramade sacha yatyuta. O son of Bharat, the mode of goodness conditions one to happiness. Passion conditions one to fruitive action. And ignorance covering one's knowledge binds one to madness. So such persons cannot hear the super soul. The people in the mode of goodness are too self-satisfied and proud. Self-satisfied with their material arrangements. In Rajas, their desires are speaking too loud. And in Tamas, they're too mad or drunk or sleeping. So now I wanted to ask you, how do we feel that the modes are actually conditioning us in our daily lives? Do the modes influence our decisions and actions? And if so, how do they? And how can we tell when we're being influenced by the modes? So we can break up into groups and discuss these. Are the modes conditioning us in our daily lives? How do the modes influence our decisions and our actions? And how can we tell that we're being influenced by the modes? How can we judge if the modes are influencing us or not? So break up into little groups, maybe 3, 4, 5 if you want. And for 5 minutes, just discuss these questions.